This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Carlson Fish Oils. Fish oil provides the vital omega-3s, EPA and DHA, which support cardiovascular, brain and nerve, vision, immune system, joint, and skin health. Carlson ensures maximum freshness by managing their fish oils from sea to shelf. All Carlson fish oils are tested by an FDA-registered laboratory for freshness, potency, and purity, and they're available in soft gels and liquid form. For more information, go to carlsonlabs.com. Carlson fish oils are available at fine health food stores nationwide. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we're going to talk to one of my favorite guests. He's the author of the number one bestseller, Wheat Belly, Dr. William Davis. And he's an individual who really has revolutionized our approach to dieting in America. There are a lot of people who promote the gluten-free diet, but he is probably the most authoritative health expert who endorses not just a wheat-free diet, but he goes well beyond that. As we'll soon find out in our discussion. He is a cardiologist, practicing originally in Milwaukee, and he has branched out into health education, and he's an author of several books, including Wheat Belly. So without further ado, here's our guest, Dr. William Davis. So it's a pleasure having you back on Intelligent Medicine.
Well, thank you for the invitation.
So let's kind of get to the heart of the matter. Wheat Belly talks about, it indicts wheat as being something that's particularly pernicious in our Western diet. So what's in wheat that makes it so bad?
You know, people focus on gluten, but the message I try to hammer into everybody's thinking is that there's so many things in this plant called wheat. It, one component, yes, is gluten, but there's other things, like the amylopectin A. That's the extremely digestible starch or carbohydrate of wheat that explains why products made of wheat, like whole grain bread and bagels and whole grain crackers, raise blood sugar sky high, higher ounce for ounce than table sugar, white sucrose. There's also another bowel toxin besides the gluten. That's called wheat germagglutinin. It's a bowel toxin. Microgram quantities can enter the bloodstream when it does. It's highly inflammatory. There are something called phytates in grains, which explains why so many people, particularly females, develop iron deficiency anemia that doesn't even respond often to iron supplementation, because the phytates bind up to 90% of all the iron in food. And so there's a long list of things in modern wheat. Now, I do believe it's important to say that modern wheat, because something happened in the 1960s when the extensive breeding experiments that were conducted for mostly purposes of increasing yield per acre changed wheat. It changed it outwardly, so it no longer stands 5 feet tall, about shoulder height to a grown adult. It stands about knee high now. It's short, stocky, very thick stalk, very large seed, very long seed head, and yield per acre is as much as eightfold higher than it used to be. So they did this for purposes of increasing yield per acre, but they changed the plant using methods, by the way, that predate genetic modification. But changed the plant extensively. And that's where I think things went from bad to worse. In some ways, I'm grateful, though, because I think all those, the finagling with the genetics of this plant magnified the harmful effects on humans, and it really brought this to light. Because when they introduced the products of this, what's called high-yield semi-dwarf wheat on the supermarket shelves, that's when we saw everything go sour. That's when we saw allergies skyrocket. That's when we saw the obesity crisis begin. That's when we saw type 2 diabetes go berserk. That's when we saw type 1 diabetes start to climb upwards. That's when we saw the increased incidence of autoimmune diseases, now achieving epidemic proportions in Western Europe and the U.S. So I think these changes, in a way, did us a favor by showing us how awful this thing was for us.
Well, indeed. And you have been, in addition to focusing on wheat as a problem, you've also decried the proliferation of gluten-free foods, because these days, I mean, so a lot of people hearing your message, they say, great, you know, I can get a gluten-free bagel. I can get gluten-free muffins. I mean, I recently went to one of the major expos, Expo East, and there was an entire gigantic room devoted to gluten-free products. You could stuff your face with them.
You know, sadly, we live in a system where if there's a profit to be made, whether it's honest or good for you or not, somebody will do it. So, you know, low-tar cigarettes were successful for many years, even though they were it was a ridiculous proposition that had no health benefits over and above that of conventional tobacco and cigarettes. Same thing here. Let's try to I'm talking as if I was a gluten-free food manufacturer. Let's try to recreate the taste and texture of wheat and gluten, and let's use cornstarch, rice flour, tapioca starch, or potato flour as our replacement ingredients. Well, what they don't tell you, or they may not be aware they should be, is that those four ingredients are among the very few foods that raise blood sugar even higher than wheat products. Mm. In fact, there are no foods, none, that raise blood sugar higher than those gluten-free replacement, what I call junk carbs. And so if you eat gluten-free bread and pasta and bagels, etc., even if they're unsugared and unsweetened, they will make you fat, cause visceral fat growth, inflammatory tummy fat, raises blood sugar sky high, and provokes all the phenomena, as you know, of glycation, glucose modification of proteins in the body, an irreversible process that leads, over years of repetitive exposure, to cataracts, hypertension, heart disease, cancer, and dementia. So these are awful foods, even though it's a $7 billion a year industry. I do know some of the insiders, by the way, in that industry, and they have admitted to me, oh, they know that these are awful products, but how do they ignore this huge market opportunity?
Well, you may have inadvertently helped them, because I think some people may not read beyond the headlines. You know, when you publicize books like Wheat Belly, people say, okay, great. You know, I just want to eat wheat and I'll lose scads and scads of weight. And then they're bitterly disappointed.
I fear you're right. That's why I spend a lot of my day, a little bit of time every day, making sure that people don't fall into that trap.
Indeed. So you share frequently on your website, and we'll talk a little bit later about the many resources that you have for the public, as well as on Facebook and via Twitter, case studies that describe some of the benefits of adhering to the Wheat Belly lifestyle. So what are some of the benefits that might accrue? Some recent case studies, perhaps?
Yeah, you know, these are just stories and photographs people send me of themselves. I get a lot of these almost every day. Weight loss, rapid weight loss is very common. Change in appearance, interestingly, is a very frequent occurrence. And that's because when you get rid of grains, and I, as you point out, I've extended this to include all other grains or seeds of grasses. All grains are promiscuous, and they share genetics among themselves quite enthusiastically. And there's lots of genetic overlap. For instance, the gliadin protein of wheat within gluten is identical in wheat. It's identical to the gliadin in rye called cecalin. It's identical to the gliadin in barley called hordein. It's very similar, by the way, to the protein in corn called zein. So the seeds of grasses, or what people call grains, are very, very closely related, overlap a lot. And so I've extended this now. I started picking on the worst of the bunch and the most popular, that is wheat, but I've since extended it to include all grains. And people see even a further increment in health and further health benefits. But people change. When they go to these things, inflammation recedes. Joint pain can subside, particularly in the arms, fingers, wrists, and elbows within the first week. Acid reflux disappears in the majority within the first week. The symptoms of irritable bowel syndrome are gone within the first week in the majority. Along with that, intestinal inflammation, joint inflammation, skin inflammation recedes. And so common redness in the face and the cheeks and chin and around the eyes is gone within the first week. There's a facial puffiness. You may not even know you have it until it's gone. And then that's why I urge people to take photographs at the start of your wheat belly journey, and then 10 days, a month, whatever, into it, and compare photographs, and people will say, you know, I didn't realize how swollen my face was, red. Here's an interesting thing. Their eyes get bigger, and that's because of receding puffiness around the eyes. A very, very visible effect. If you have autoimmune diseases, it takes a little longer, a few weeks, but most people have their symptoms quiet down, like rheumatoid arthritis symptoms or lupus.
Or autoimmune thyroiditis, where clearly there's a gluten connection.
Hashimoto's thyroiditis,
there.
Exactly, yeah. The 200 diseases of autoimmunity, with rare exceptions, I've seen just about every condition recede or go away. Now, there are, as you know, there are additional efforts that really stack the odds in your favor, efforts like correcting vitamin D deficiency and correcting bowel flora disruption. But a big, powerful start is wheat and grain elimination. Lots of mind effects. There's a dramatic drop in appetite. That gliadin protein within the gluten molecule, upon partial digestion, yields opiates that are very potent appetite stimulants. Get rid of it, and after you go through an opiate withdrawal syndrome, by the way, for the first week, nausea, headache, depression, and fatigue, you emerge out of that first week, and you feel wonderful, and you don't get hungry anymore. So the followers, if you'll follow us on social media, people will see that. People say, you know, I had breakfast. I had a couple of eggs and some bacon or whatever. And then I wasn't hungry until about 4 p.m. None of that every 2-hour hunger business that people who consume grains get because of the gliadin-derived opiates that stimulate appetite. So people often come to me with this, these sort of questions. I'm getting worried. I'm losing weight. Am I getting too skinny? So
it should only be for a lot of people, right?
So getting too skinny in the midst of the worst crisis of obesity the world has ever witnessed. migraine headaches very commonly recede. Menstrual symptoms in menstruating females will often diminish, not go away, of course, but diminish. Fertility can be restored in a lot of ladies when they lose visceral fat, particularly those with polycystic ovarian syndrome. They have dramatic reduction in testosterone levels. They have reversal of a lot of the testosterone-type phenomena like facial hair. And fertility can be restored, and their blood sugars drop back into the normal range. Speaking of blood sugars, diabetics come off insulin and often come off their oral drugs to the point where many diabetics become non-diabetic, pre-diabetics become non-pre-diabetic. So it impressed me the more I did this over the years how many conditions recede with this lifestyle.
Well, absolutely. And they're actually similar diets. The Walls diet for MS and other autoimmune diseases. Of course, the Paleo diet of Lauren Cordain, which I think you're very familiar with. The Perfect 30 diet now recommends grain elimination. Are there commonalities between the Wheat Belly program and these other diets?
Yeah, isn't it wonderful? We're all converging.
Yep,
Recognizing a lot of commonality. There's some differences at the edges, and that's okay. I think it makes for good conversations, like Paleo, for instance, or Primal, Dr. Cordain's approach. They often completely eliminate dairy. I have real concerns about dairy, but my view is there are certain forms of dairy products, like butter, which is almost entirely fat, mm-hmm. which is probably on the whole good for a lot of people. It's got a lot of butyrate, for instance, that nourishes, that helps heal the intestinal lining and helps generate metabolic improvements via the butyrate that has metabolic benefits. So we differ a little bit on some of the details, but all in all, there's lots of overlap. And, you know, if people like the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and USDA, Food Pyramid, Food Plate, all that, if they got it right at the start, we wouldn't have anything to talk about in diet. But the reason why so many of us have been struggling and coming up with ideas and thinking about diet is because they got it so wrong, and people are looking for answers. And I think the big common thread, though there are some differences, the big common thread here is no grains.
Is this like celiac disease, where you can't have a morsel of wheat or gluten? or in this case, grains, or else you'll rekindle the symptoms? Is there an opportunity for people to, you know, that they're at a party, somebody offers them a cupcake or a bagel, or it's their birthday? Is it advisable to go completely cold turkey and stay off entirely?
Yeah, very interesting. So this is largely, of course, of the many, many people who follow this, the vast, vast majority do not have celiac disease, and the vast majority who've been grain-free get quite ill when they're re-exposed. Whether the exposure was inadvertent or intentional, pardon me, they'll get quite ill. The most common symptom is gastrointestinal distress, diarrhea, and bloating. If you had joint pain will come back.
Mm-hmm. I've seen
that. If you had migraine headaches will return. If you had depressive symptoms or suicidal thoughts, they will return often for several days. Some of the worst reactions are in people with autoimmune or neurological conditions, and they can return for months. I had one guy who had rheumatoid arthritis who responded wonderfully. It took him 18 months, by the way, but he was 90% better. In symptoms and the disfiguring changes in his hands. Everything was receding. He got off two medicines out of three. He went on a trip to Germany, and he said, I'll be damned if I don't have a piece of pumpernickel while I'm here. He has a piece of pumpernickel, and all his rheumatoid arthritis symptoms returned within hours, and he had to go back on the drugs for 6 months before he got back to where he was before. Now, that's an extreme. That's not how most people experience it, but it can be quite extreme. So, and that's, of course, in a person without celiac disease. And so I urge people, once they're wheat and grain free, to stay wheat and grain free, or else they'll pay a pretty awful price that can last for several days.
Indeed. Is this a very low carbohydrate diet, or are there alternative carbohydrate sources?
I'm sure we get it
that you can have meat, fish, poultry, eggs, and lots of fresh vegetables, but is it a very low-carb diet?
Yeah. You know, we work in a world where so many people have type 2 diabetes or pre-diabetes or just have high blood sugars or hemoglobin A1Cs, and lots of people who want to lose weight. And so what I ask people to do is wheat and grain elimination is huge. But it doesn't mean wheat and grain elimination with lots of Coca-Cola and lots of sugary candies. And so I urge people to go back to real whole foods and to limit carbohydrates. Now, the downside of limiting carbohydrates are changes in bowel flora. So we also have to factor in this sounds a little complicated, but it's not that complicated. We have to factor in getting the kinds of fibers you need, not for bowel regularity, but for nourishing bowel flora, because starchy foods tend to be richer in fibers that nourish bowel flora, particularly legumes. And so I also fold in advice in our program to make sure that people get these so-called prebiotic fibers. And that takes care of all the downside of low carbing. You know, we used to see, before we understood bowel flora, not that we understand bowel flora perfectly yet, nobody does, but in the old days, we would put somebody on a no wheat, no grains, ultra low carb diet. It worked wonderfully. Blood pressure drops, blood sugar drops. They lose weight. They feel better. They look better. Everything is going great. And then about year three, they start having these vague abdominal symptoms, constipation, and blood sugar, blood pressure, all these would deteriorate a little bit. Not a lot, just a little bit. Like maybe triglycerides would go from 40 to 78. And it was never clear what that was all about, but it's clear now that was from a low-grade dysbiosis, a changed bowel flora from lack of these prebiotic fibers. So now we go back, we add back these prebiotics. It's very easy, and you get all these wonderful effects, a drop in blood sugar, a drop in blood pressure, a drop in insulin, improved sleep, better mood, reduced anxiety, better bowel regularity, and probably protection from colon cancer risk long-term.
What are some of these prebiotic foods? And by the way, what you described is actually what some patients who went to Dr. Atkins or did the Atkins diet encountered, is they had benefits in terms of weight loss and, you know, cholesterol, triglycerides, but they had GI problems. So what can you add that will support the microbiome?
You know, I always ask, how do primitive people like the Yanomamo, say, or the Hadza in sub-Saharan Africa, how do these people do it? Well, you can actually watch, you know, the Discovery Channel and National Geographic, and you'll see them digging in the dirt with sticks or bones or rocks, and they dig for these underground tubers or legumes. Well, you know, you and I can't do that. We live in cities. I live in Wisconsin where the ground is frozen several months a year, and you and I have better things to do than dig outside in the dirt in the forest. So we recreate these experiences by eating certain sources of these fibers. We mimic these. Because we can't get a lot of the things that primitive people get, we mimic this behavior by eating small servings of legumes like chickpeas and hummus. But we have to keep a bit low on that, no more than a quarter to a half cup, I tell people, because that exceeds 15 grams net carbohydrates, the threshold for raising blood sugar and triggering the formation of small LDL particles that causes heart disease.
So in other words, you don't prohibit legumes, but you put a little bit of a cap on their consumption because you can OD on them from a carbohydrate standpoint.
Yes. In the modern age, it's so easy to do that because so many people have had some degree of insulin resistance in the past and can rekindle it very easily. Now, there are some odd sources, like raw white potatoes and green unripe bananas and cognac or glucomannan and fructooligosaccharides or FOS.
You don't mean the drink cognac. It's spelled K-O-N-J-A-C or something like that, right?
That's right.
Cognac.
Yes, thanks.
Yeah.
That's right.
Because some people are thinking, hey, that's the drinking man's diet. I can relate
that's
to that.
That's right. Inulin is another one. It comes as a powder you can buy. So if anybody wants these, I list them on a blog post I made called Cultivate the Garden Called Bowel Flora. It's on the Wheat Belly blog. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a starting list of things to know. So we fold these things into people's programs, and all those problems that you and I have seen, for instance, on the Atkins diet, go away. And you enjoy all the benefits with none of that downside that came. You know, we can't blame poor Dr. Atkins. He was working back in the 80s and 90s, and this was not known back then. But now you and I know that bowel flora is crucial to health. And we live in a time, an age, where so many things we're exposed to, whether it's antibiotics along the way for some infection, or antibiotic residues that aren't supposed to be in our meat but are, or perfluoroarsenic acid from Teflon. There's literally thousands of compounds, chemicals we're exposed to that have potential for disrupting bowel flora. And so it's our effort to try to restore normal bowel flora. And while there's still many lessons to learn, I'm sure, this has been working exceptionally well.
Okay, well, this is a great introduction to the Wheat Belly philosophy, the Wheat Belly program. But I got a lot more questions, and we divide these podcasts into two parts. So do you mind joining us for part two when we'll discuss something important, which is, and you alluded to it earlier, how to survive wheat withdrawal, because that is an issue for some individuals attempting this diet.
Terrific.
And other themes. We'll rejoin Dr. William Davis in just a moment. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.